Financial Survival, a daily talk show that offers opinions and commentary on the political and economic events of the day. It's Friday, May 25th. The Memorial Day holiday is upon us. I'm Dave Allen. Melody Cedarstrom will take over hosting duties in the second segment with her guest James Corbett in an interview taped this past Wednesday evening, which you'll know just by their discussion on North Korea. Let's get straight to today's market report. Well, starting the week at a little over 1287, gold finished the week at just shy of 1301, down about $3.60 for the day. Silver was similar. It started the week at 1643, finished the week at 13, down about 17 cents for the day. Platinum finished the day down about 1.4% at $899, and palladium closed up a half a percent at $980. West Texas crude oil fell somewhat sharply today, ending the day down to about $67.72. That's attributed largely to Russia and Saudi Arabia, who are reconsidering their output caps. As you may have heard, the Russian energy minister met with his Saudi Arabian counterpart in St. Petersburg to talk about the cap, which has aimed to keep about 1.8 million barrels a day off the market since January 2017. The parties are now considering a gradual exit to that deal to compensate for falling production in crisis-stricken Venezuela and anticipated export disruption from Iran, which, as you know, faces renewed U.S. sanctions in the upcoming months. The international benchmark Brent crude also fell about a little over 3%, $2.42, to finish at $76.37. Let's see, that's after a 3.5-year high of $80.50 last week, going back to November of 2014. The ministers are considering a supply increase of as much as a million barrels a day to cool the market. The Saudis are particularly concerned about the impact of oil prices of above $80 on consumer nations like China and India. In the U.S., output continues to rise toward 11 million barrels a day, with drilling here threatening to unseat Russia as the world's top producer. However, bottlenecks in the Permian Basin here, the nation's biggest shale oil-producing region, mean U.S. drillers could fail to meet growing global demand for petroleum. The pause in the oil price rally could be good news for drivers, especially with this holiday weekend, although it probably won't be felt until later. The national average for regular gasoline in the states has risen to $3 a gallon, the highest level again since 2014, prior to the historic oil price crash. Let's see. Let's go back here for a second. The dollar index, bear with me 1 second. The U.S. dollar finished up slightly, 43.43 to finish at 94.18. And looking at the U.S. bond market, all of the major notes, the rates for the notes were down. The U.S. 2-year note finished at 2.48%, down about 3 basis points. The 10-year yield, the bellwether yield, which many consumer loans are based on, finished down slightly, about 5 basis points, 2.931%. And the U.S. 30-year note finished down about 4 basis points at 3.09%. Remember, as Melody, Butch, Paul, and I have been telling you, a flattening yield curve should give investors cause to pay closer attention to rates in the coming weeks and months. An inverse yield curve is predicted every subsequent recession since 1950. You ought to also watch out for any investments you have in high-yield junk corporate bonds, which Moody's Investor Service today warned of a particularly large wave of defaults in the offing. Let's switch over to the paper markets, which, let's see, the S&P 500 finished down about a quarter of a percentage point, 6.43 to 27.21. NASDAQ down about a little over a tenth of a percent or 9.43 points to just below 7.74.34. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average finished down about four tenths of a percent, down roughly 91, closing at 24.721 for the week. Now, interestingly, the CBO Volatility Index considered its sporadic but steady decline since the beginning of the month, although the VIX did close slightly up at 13.27. The index, commonly referred to as the VIX, surged as high as 50 earlier this year before trading generally between 15 and 25 levels. While that range is just about in line with the index's long-term average, it's a major departure from recent years. The VIX's average level this year is a little over 17. That's higher than the average for all of 2015, which was 16.7, and also 2016, which was 15.8. Last year's the average was just 11.1. The average since 1995 is 21. Now, of course, we're coming off historically low levels, but that says a lot about what market watchers are calling a relatively new era of volatility after such a long period of historically quiet market moves. One analyst, in fact, said today the anomaly that we saw in 2016 and 2017 was the really low VIX. So the tail risk event, or the black swan event, was a slow motion car crash of 2017, where we saw the VIX trading at as low as 9. So moving out of that extremely low volatility event into what is a more normal market is going to feel like the stock market has suddenly become significantly more volatile. In fact, a lot of us gold and silver observers are wondering why it's not even higher. And the volatility has picked up across other asset classes as well. We're seeing a pickup in the volatility in the treasury market as well as the currency market. And when that happens, it usually bleeds over into the stock market eventually. Look for that to happen this year, ladies and gentlemen. Now, in other news, President Donald Trump said this morning that his administration has restarted dialogue with North Korea following his cancellation of the historic summit. We'll see what happens. We're talking to them now. That's what he told reporters as he left the White House on his way to speak at the U.S. Naval Academy graduation. The president added that the scrap meeting with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un could still happen. It's unclear whether Trump meant that Washington and Pyongyang had restarted direct negotiations or what form those communications have actually taken. The summit, part of a process the U.S. hopes is going to lead to North Korea abandoning its nuclear and missile programs, had been set for June 12th in Singapore. It would have been the first time a U.S. president met with a North Korean leader. Yesterday, Trump abruptly abandoned the summit amid what he called tremendous anger and open hostility displayed by Kim. A senior White House official said North Korea had stopped direct communication with the U.S. over the previous week. In a statement issued last evening in response to the summit cancellation, North Korean official Kim Kwi-gwan said Pyongyang is willing to give the U.S. time and opportunities to reconsider negotiations at any time, at any format, end quote. Trump's remarks this morning marked a sharp turn from the aggressive tone he took yesterday following his decision to cancel the summit. Trump said then, a greatly enhanced U.S. military is ready if necessary should North Korea take foolish or reckless action. However, Trump also stressed that he wants a peaceful resolution and was still open to talks. He said nobody ought to be anxious despite the cancellation of the talks designed to head off North Korea's development of nuclear weapons. Yeah, let's see what happens. You know, if they're going to reinstate strong sanctions, as Trump has said, the strongest sanctions ever imposed, it's going to send the markets spiraling. So obviously we're all staying tuned to see what's going to happen with this situation. You know, Japan Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said today that the world should keep pushing for a U.S. North Korea summit to take place. He wants to see concrete steps toward North Korea dismantling its weapons program. And he should know, since some of the North's missile tests over the past year have taken place over and around the Japanese island. Let's see. Moving on, the Trump administration is telling Congress it has come to an agreement to boost Chinese telecommunications company ZTE. As part of that deal, ZTE would pay a financial penalty, revamp its management, and hire American compliance officers. The U.S. would then scrap a ban on the company buying American products under the agreement, although it's unclear how firm the reported deal is at this point. Now, this is certainly consistent with what Trump said on Tuesday, namely that he had envisioned a large fine of maybe more than $1 billion, plus a new management, a new board, and very, very strict rules. Trump also added that he wants or would want ZTE to buy a big percentage of its parts and equipment from American companies. Now, an agreement to revive ZTE, which has argued the U.S. penalties would cripple its operations, could possibly help critical trade talks between the U.S. and China. Trump has called the ZTE negotiations part of broader talks to address alleged Chinese trade abuses, though his top advisors labeled ZTE nothing more than an enforcement issue. Washington and Beijing both are trying to cement a deal that would avoid potentially damaging tariffs. Trump has said he agreed to help the firm, which is a major smartphone supplier in the American market, at the request of Chinese President Xi Jinping. The prospect of this deal to aid the phone market has prompted bipartisan criticism from Capitol Hill. Many lawmakers have argued that any deal would hurt national security because the U.S. government was punishing the firm for violating sanctions on Iran and North Korea. Some members of Congress also contend that the firm's equipment, the smartphones themselves, pose a cybersecurity risk, afraid of perhaps Chinese spying on Americans. Earlier this week, the Senate Banking Committee overwhelmingly passed an amendment introduced by Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland to limit Trump's ability to remove the penalties on ZTE. Following the news earlier today, Van Hollen said there's a strong bipartisan wave here, this resistance to this idea of the president trading away what they call national security considerations. Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, also a frequent critic of Trump's push to save ZTE, called the reported agreement a great deal for ZTE and China. Now, Congress will need to act, presumably on behalf of U.S. citizens, he tweeted. And speaking of sanctions and agreements, Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has issued 5 demands to Europe that would be difficult for the continent's leaders to meet as they seek to salvage the 2015 nuclear accord now that the U.S. has pulled out. Diplomats from the remaining parties, Britain, China, France, Germany, and Russia, are meeting today in Vienna with their Iranian counterparts to see what can be done. You know, analysts here are skeptical that Europe can preserve the deal in the face of potentially powerful U.S. sanctions. But ahead of the meeting, Khamenei set these five guidelines, which include the following. Number one, Europeans must bring resolution to the United Nations Security Council protesting U.S. violation of a U.N. resolution which endorsed the Iran nuclear deal. Number two, Iran's missiles and regional presence absolutely may not be discussed with European leaders. Three, Europeans must clearly oppose all American sanctions against Iran. That could be real difficult for a couple of the parties. Number four, if the Americans try to interfere with Iran's oil sales, the Europeans must guarantee the purchase of oil from Iran, another particularly difficult and problematic notion. And number five, Europe must guarantee Iranian banking connections. That could be a deal breaker. We shall see. Khamenei said that Iran could start ramping up its nuclear activity, which it agreed to limit in 2015 in exchange for sanctions relief, if the accord known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPA, no longer benefits the country. You know, on Monday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo issued his own list of a dozen concessions Iran must make before Washington lifts sanctions and normalizes ties with the country. So it looks like Pompeo went big in his speech. Khamenei, in return, seems to be doing the same thing, if not even going for bigger. Now, let's see. Gold poised to hit $1,600? We shall see. We'll finish this segment of today's show with a look at our friend gold. Now, as listeners know, May has not been kind to gold and silver, for that matter, although the last couple of days was a decent rebound. But remember, gold is a finite resource. According to a recent study in Science Daily, we know that most of the available gold was initially deposited in the Earth's mantle. But mining companies can't mine there. Plus, because of technical limitations, mining companies can only determine the probability that gold mineral deposits will actually be in certain locations close enough to the Earth's surface. Now, a spike in gold exploration spending between 2006 and 8 created the conditions for mining companies to boost production over the last decade, but many people in the gold industry believe and agree that we've reached peak production and are heading down gold mining mountain. With supply down and demand just as high and increasing, in China, for example, prices for gold are likely going to be on the rise, especially with rising geopolitical uncertainty across the globe. Call Discount Gold and Silver now at 1-800-375-4188. We've been delivering financial security since 1995. The music means it's time for a break. Melody will be back with James Corbett, but first, these messages.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit csetalkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm pleased to welcome back to the program today the always informative James Corbett. And as you listeners know, James is the founder and editor of the Corbett Report, but he's also the lead writer for the International Forecaster, to which I will always, always have a very special place in my heart for Bob Chapman, the founder of the International Forecaster. And he couldn't have invited a better writer and person than James to take over that position. So if you need a, I guess they're still giving out complimentary issues of the International Forecaster. I encourage the listeners to go to theinternationalforecaster.com. And can they pick that up from your website, James?
Well, best place to go would be theinternationalforecaster.com. And, yes, there is a free sample issue. It's up linked up there on the front page, so you can click on that.
Okay, fantastic. So, again, you can visit James's website, thecorbettreport.com. And glad to have you back. And we talked about how you were prior to you coming on, and you're a little under the weather, so let's just get started right away. And being the host of the program, it's always not sure which topic I want to begin with, and so I'm going to ask you first, is there anything in particular in your mind today that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Oh, boy. That's a good one. Well, as you say, I've been under the weather.
I thought I'd throw that ball into your court.
Yeah. Don't put it on me. I'm happy to go where you want to go.
Well, okay, let's talk about Japan. It's almost like, it seems like your country and Japan, well, your country, Japan, and the United States have something in common when it comes to Social Security costs. For the United States, it's projected the present value of unfunded obligations under Social Security was approximately $11.4 trillion over the 75-year forecast period of 2016 to 2090. In other words, that amount would have to be set aside in 2016 so that the principal and interest would cover the shortfall for 75 years. The social benefit costs in Japan are going to grow more than 50% over the next two decades as the country's population rapidly ages, and this is according to the government's estimates. How are these governments going to sustain these programs, and what happens to the elderly when there is no more money?
Well, in fact, it's even more of a sticky issue in Japan because there's the demographic factor here, which is, I think, the overarching factor with regards to the future of the Japanese economy in general. So for just to put some numbers on this, the 2018 budget for the Japanese Social Security program is going to be something in the order of 121 trillion yen, which is approximately over $1 trillion U.S., however, as you say, by 2040, that's projected to rise to 190 trillion yen, i.e. Almost $2 trillion, which it reflects a couple of things. One is that is the 2040 is the time at which the amount of people over age 65 is projected to peak in Japan. So that will be the maximum strain. And that will also reflect, of course, fewer young people actually paying into the system, which raises that gigantic question of, well, and how do you pay for it, except for just adding on more and more debt. I suppose the quote-unquote good part or good side of this is that, well, since it peaks at 2040, that's the largest projected population of over 65s, then it will go down from there. But, of course, the entire population is going to be going down from there. And Japan is already a shrinking population, less and less young people, which means less and less young workers to support those retirees. So it is an insoluble puzzle, really. I mean, there's no way to solve it other than by going deeper and deeper into debt, barring some sort of amazing economic miracle, some sort of free energy or whatever that transforms our economic understanding. There's really no way out of it for Japan at this point. It's baked into the demographic cake. And it's one of those things where as long as people continue to believe and trust in the system and the BOJ and the yen, then I guess they can continue to float their little Ponzi scheme. But one imagines that can't last forever.
Well, you know, something when you have an elderly population, and this requires more workers in the medical and the nursing care industries. So when you have less of a younger population, then you have who's going to work to help take care of the elderly population? Japan's a little bit different because I think you're more family-oriented to where you do take care of your elderly, a little bit not so much like that in the United States, I don't think, to the same degree.
Right, yeah. Yeah, no, that's very true. There's still often you'll have three generations living in a single household here. That's quite common. So there is more of a family structure. But I have seen more high-tech alternatives being proposed, including, of course, robots going to be providing healthcare to the elderly, which is apparently the next trend that's going to be taking off here. So we'll see how this all plays out socially. But as you say, it's a sheer demographic issue. The numbers don't lie and the numbers can't really be fudged. There are just fewer and fewer young workers paying for more and more elderly people, and that is a completely unsustainable system.
Can these governments get, can Japan get to 2040 without a collapse prior to?
It's a real question. I mean, just extending the current status quo out to 2040, one really wonders how Japan would be able to maintain that much debt for that long. However, I mean, there are so many different factors geopolitically that could completely change the entire nexus and the entire calculation between now and then that one really wonders, you know, what will the world look like in 2040? And one thing that is for sure is that the current status of China in the region is going to be different in 2040. One would assume that China will be much more of a powerhouse and potentially much more of an important, ally of Japan, or at some point, in some way, a trading partner, or in some sense, is going to be more important in terms of the Japanese relationship. And that might, in some way, change that balance. Because, of course, right now, Japan is essentially a proxy for the United States in the Asia-Pacific region. And if and when that stops happening, there are lots of different ways that could play out. Well, militarily, obviously, geopolitically, obviously, but economically as well, because economically, Japan has primarily set up its post-World War II era as being an export market or an export country, which is essentially exporting to the U.S. economy. Well, again, that's going to change over the coming decades. There may be some way in which there could be an Asia-Pacific renaissance of sorts, economically speaking, that's brought about by some sort of shift in geopolitical relations. But again, that's all conjectural at this point. Just extending out the current status quo from here to 2040, it's a genuine question how Japan can continue floating the largest debt to GDP ratio in the developed world.
Well, and this is exactly, there was an article from Politico, and it talked about President Trump's, you know, to make America great again, it could morph the United States into Japan. And, you know, Japan has some of the highest living standards anywhere, it's my understanding, ultra-low crime, top-rate infrastructure, longest lifespans. So, you know, it might not be so bad to morph into Japan. But yet the economy, as you're mentioning, is another story. You've had deflation, the world's largest debt burden, as you mentioned, and they are making those. There is a little bit more of a demand from China, and to see Japan's economy grow about 1%. But then it all comes back to, you know, it is the stimulus addiction, you know, that not only Japan has, but the United States has.
Yes,
and every other country out there.
Exactly, yes. Well, the Bank of Japan very much followed in line with the Federal Reserve and its reaction to the 2008 crisis by basically pumping money into the economy. The Japanese has this, the Bank of Japan has especially gone overboard with that, directly purchasing government bonds in a bid to keep the yield curve down to zero. But also, not directly buying stocks themselves, but buying into indexes. That basically means that the Bank of Japan is a de facto owner of an increasing amount of the Japanese stock market, which is clearly not a sustainable sustainable position. It's just something that has kept the bubble going, and we've seen some promising sort of Japanese economic indicators over the last several quarters. We had a run of GDP growth that was just dashed by a GDP contraction, but overall there are some hopeful things. But again, I think everything with regards to the Japanese economic situation has to have a gigantic asterisk next to it. I mean, you mentioned, for example, the infrastructure here in Japan being well maintained. That's true, but a lot of that is due to government make work projects that just keep people employed, thereby keeping the unemployment rate down, but a lot of it just digging up roads in order to pave them over again, not really productive activity, just kind of, again, the government basically paying people to have something that resembles work, which is a win-win for everyone, except, of course, it just adds to that growing debt. Lots of things like that, everything you could say that's positive has a negative side to it. Everything that's negative also has some sort of positive balance to it. So it's difficult to say. I mean, it's not a horrible place to live, at least at this point, but one could imagine that the wheels could fall off this track very quickly if there were some other destabilizing influences. I think some of the other things to keep in mind, yes, Japan has the worst debt to GDP ratio in the developed world, but it's also one of the largest creditor nations in the world, which is strange.
Yes.
Because a lot of the debt is owed internally to, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Yamada, who bought their Japanese government bonds as part of their retirement savings all their life. So a lot of that debt is internal, and they've extended a lot of credit around the world. There's things like that that are baked into the Japanese cake that make it difficult to parse out, you know, in which way the dominoes could or would fall. And I think it probably depends more on global events and which way the wind's blowing in terms of the U.S. economy or a Chinese economy or global economy than anything internal to Japan specifically.
Well, you know, you have Japan, Russia, Turkey. They have warned the United States about potential retaliation for its tariffs on steel and aluminum. The WTO said yesterday, and it's bringing the total U.S. tariff bill to around $3.5 billion annually. So these three countries have detailed their compensation claims, notification to the World Trade Body, and this is, the similar moves by the European Union, India, and China. We also know that, Russia said that the U.S. tariffs that were imposed in March by President Trump would add duties of $538 million to its annual steel and aluminum exports. Japan put the sum at $440 million. Turkey added a further $267. So my question is, and we know that the tariff, they never called it a tariff war between the United States and China, but now they said there is no, the war's off, you know, there's no tariffs, and, you know, life goes on, and it's, you're seeing these relationships change.
Yeah.
And you're seeing these, and I don't know if these are these are big deals or not, or if it's just a bunch of smoke, a lot of hot air.
Well, I think this is important. I mean, because let's keep in mind, these were tariffs that were ostensibly, supposedly aimed at China, who, as you say, now apparently things are patched over and they're not going to have a trade war or something along those lines. They've at least made nice publicly. Who knows how that's really going to play out. But so this is really collateral damage from these tariffs, or seemingly so, that are hurting U.S. allies or ostensible allies like the EU, like Japan, like other countries, including ostensible U.S. foes, if you want to put them that way, like Russia. But at any rate, it's hurting a lot of countries, and they are now taking it to the WTO. And basically, they're arguing that these tariffs are safeguards, which is basically you can legitimately protect your struggling industry from an unforeseen surge in imports by using safeguards, but you have to pay the other World Trade Organization members who are going to lose out on that restricted trade by rebalancing that trade relationship. And if you don't, then they can basically fine you or charge you for the difference. And that's what's going on here. And the U.S. is saying, no, these aren't safeguards. We're protecting, you know, vital industry for national security. So depending how the WTO rules on this, as you say, the full U.S. Tariff bill could be $3.5 billion per year, which is a pretty big shot in the foot. I mean, shooting themselves in the foot. Again, ostensibly, this was a part of some sort of trade, if not trade war, at least some sort of trade tensions with China. But now all of these other countries are lining up to basically hit back at the U.S. for being the collateral damage in this. It's just another sign. There's been so many lately, but there's just another sign that the U.S. in its stepping away from the world community in so many different ways in the last couple of years is, again, shooting itself in the foot and taking itself down a peg and threatening relationships with erstwhile allies, in this case Japan or the EU. And of course, EU tensions already heightened by that Iran deal pullout, which now Iran is saying, well, the only way to keep the deal going is if the EU basically recognizes the U.S. as abrogating the deal and upholds all of its rules and basically driving the wedge between the EU and the U.S. So we'll have to see how the EU reacts to that. But there's a lot of these kind of wedge issues that one would think wouldn't have to be wedge issues necessarily. It just seems the U.S. in its kind of withdrawal is also withdrawing from all of its kind of alliances and potential for geopolitical clout. It's basically losing geopolitical capital in these types of economic moves that are hurting even some of its closest allies.
I don't ever remember a time when there was just so much pull from all various nations, and it just seems like there's so much, I don't know if it's a strong turmoil or disagreements or just so much pressure from all areas coming from all directions. And it seems like the world stock markets just continue to roll along. Like there is not a care in the world, and I get all the, algorithms and, you know, the manipulations and all that. I understand all that, but it still surprises me that there's just no reactions to anything.
Yeah, it's a very strange time in a lot of different ways, and I think we're going to be seeing. I think there's a lot of issues that are bubbling under the surface that will be rising up the ladder in terms of pressing need to actually solve them before all of this ends. And I think obviously some of them playing out here in the Asia Pacific, including I think most notably the North Korea issue. But there are so many different issues like that, as you say, are pulling the U.S. and everyone else in multiple different directions at once, and they all seem to be coming to a head.
We're heading into a break, ladies and gentlemen. Please stay tuned. I'm here with James Corbett. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and we'll be right back after these few short messages.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold. gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. 1-800-375-4188. Please visit the website at dgscoins.com. dgscoins.com. And I'm pleased to be talking with James Corbett of the Corbett Report. Make sure you visit his website, thecorbettreport.com. And of course, he's also the lead writer for the International Forecaster. Going into the break, you were talking about, or you mentioned some things that are bubbling underneath the surface, and certainly it is, of late, we have the U.S. gave Iran a list of demands on Monday, demanding that Iran make sweeping changes, from dropping its nuclear program to pulling out of the Syrian civil war, or face severe economic sanctions. As they're trying to harden the approach to Tehran. Would you care to update your thoughts on where we're leading with the Iran situation?
Well, not to a happy place, as far as can be seen, to say the least. But apparently, at least according to Reuters, and how could they ever be wrong, the latest headline is that Iranian officials are split over their response to U.S. demands. So at least some of the Iranian officials are at least thinking about swallowing what others are calling the cup of poison. So it's obviously a contentious issue, and it's going to be a long way before this comes to any sort of resolution, either happy or otherwise. But I think that the probably the most interesting part of this to me is going to be the European Union's response. And we've already seen that they're threatening to, or perhaps they already have passed legislation that will penalize EU firms for going along with the US sanctions against Iran. So now EU firms are coming under a pincher where either they go along, continue with their financial dealings in Iran as before and risk U.S. sanctions, or they cut those deals out and risk EU sanctions. So it's a weird situation. Again, this is such a strange sort of situation that's developing, and I think this portends a lot more than just Iran. I think this really does portend the future of 21st century geopolitics as it is starting to form around, again, broadly speaking, some sort of Iran, Russia, China axis of some sort, being a sort of quasi-alternative to the U.S. hegemony. And if the EU starts moving more towards that Iran, Russia, China side, which it has a lot of economic incentive to do, I mean, of course, for one major point, Russia remains one of the larger gas suppliers for the EU, and Russia shutting off the gas means a cold winter for the EU. So they're still dependent in that sense. And of course, with growing exports to the Chinese economy, which is becoming a growing importer of European goods, There are definitely economic gains to be made on that side of the equation, and I think the EU is really starting to contemplate its relationship with the US and how it's going to move forward. So I think this really does speak to a much broader situation, and the Iranian deal and whatever is happening around it is just sort of a window into that change that's happening right now. And obviously the US is going to try to push as hard as it can, and there are some Iranians who might be in favor of that. The other, of course, possibility is that this gives sort of fire in the belly to the Iranian hardliners, like former President Ahmadinejad, who have been warning all along. The U.S. is, you know, they're the great Satan. Their agreements aren't worth the paper they're signed on. They've been saying that for years, and well, it looks like Trump has proved them right. So it does give certain impetus to the hardliners to maybe make a resurgence in Iran, which could again completely change the political calculus of what's going on in that country and amongst its allies, and what's happening in Syria, and what's happening with Israel. So again, there's so much at stake here, and all I can say is it's going to be extremely interesting to see how this plays out. I'm not going to make any predictions or guesses, but I think that whatever way it plays out is going to be an extremely important clue as to the shape of things to come in the coming decades.
I wonder, this isn't even worth wondering about, but if Trump had not become president, where we would be in today's world. I mean, what would we do? What would we have to talk about if none of these things were happening? And, you know, but I'm sure Iran would not have continued the agreement that was made anyway. And, you know, we all know where they were headed and so forth. So, these things could have happened even with wouldn't matter who was elected president.
Well, that's a counterfactual game, and you know, you could play that all day, but I don't know. We're living in this timeline, so we'll just have to make the most of it.
Trump disinvites China to joint exercises. The Pentagon said that today it withdrew an invitation for China to participate in a multinational naval exercise the United States it was hosting this summer. And again, this shows more tension between Pacific powers. The move comes amid high-stakes maneuvering over North Korea's nuclear program. That is scheduled to be the subject of the meeting June 12th between President Trump and the North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. Trump says he's not sure that the meeting will go on with North Korea on June 12th, but Pompeo came out and said today that, you know, we're working real hard to make sure that that does happen.
Right. So, a couple of different things there. One is this Rim of the Pacific exercise, which is RIMPAC, for those in Pentagon speak. It's a biennial exercise, so it last one was held in 2016, and the Chinese did participate in that one. I believe they sent 5 ships to participate in the 2016 version of that. But, yes, they've been disinvited from the 2018 exercise that's going to be held, I believe, later this summer. Specifically, the Pentagon citing China's development of various islands in the South China Sea in a military fashion against promises that it had made to the international community that it wouldn't do so. For example, the People's Liberation Army Air Force, the PLAAF, has announced that it successfully organized the takeoff and landing of several bombers, including the nuclear-capable H-6K, on an unspecified island in the South China Sea. So that kind of militarism is ostensibly what the Pentagon is reacting to here in the disinvitation, and seems fairly reasonable, actually, for a change, considering what's at stake in the region and how upset a lot of China's neighbors are over this type of basically hegemonic-like claim over the South China Sea. China is basically putting up a pretty large stake in trying to enact their so-called nine-dash line, which means that they believe that they control a large part of the South China Sea, including portions that are either not claimed by anyone or claimed by different powers in the region. So it's a pretty important issue, and I'm not sure to what extent this is going to break China's heart, not being able to participate in this exercise, but I think it is a sheer sign on the diplomatic stage of what's really coming with regards to the relationship here. But as you say, this is leading up to the June 12th summit, or at least maybe the June 12th Singapore maybe. Summit between Trump and Kim Jong-un. At the moment, it's still up in the air whether this is really going to take place. And the latest that we're hearing is that China and the U.S. have agreed to keep pressure on North Korea to denuclearize, and that includes things like taking into account, well, what kind of security guarantees can we give North Korea if they do give up their nuclear program and blah, blah, blah. But again, it's all just rhetoric and nothingness until they actually get into a negotiating position. But will that even happen? They're still planning a June 12th meeting, but they're saying that it's not definitive that it's going to happen, and it'll probably require more high-level summits between the U.S. and North Korea between now and then to make sure that everything's on track for that summit. So it's still not apparent whether that's really going ahead, and if so, in what form. I believe Trump has said that there will be some sort of summit eventually, but it may not be June 12th. So we'll see. We'll see how that continues to develop, and we'll see what North Korea, how North Korea continues to react. We saw that the U.S. and South Korea were participating in one of their annual military exercises recently, and that really infuriated the North Koreans because, of course, that involved things like flying nuclear-capable bombers over the Korean Peninsula and basically practicing for an all-out invasion of North Korea. For some reason, that kind of upsets the North Koreans, so they canceled some meetings with South Korea over that issue in particular. So things are off to a bit of a rocky start. We'll see if that they can be recovered by that June 12th deadline. Again, I think everyone should be hoping for some sort of settlement. Yes. It would be great to see peace on the Korean Peninsula after 60-plus years, maybe 70, almost going on 70 years now. But we'll have to see if we can get to that finish line.
Some say that even North Korea, Iran, everyone avoids the Middle East. I mean, that's another area that is ready to boil over into something. I'm not sure anybody really knows what at this point in time, but certainly we've seen tensions increase there. We have all these hot spots around the world. Is the Middle East really something we should be concerned about, even maybe more so than Iran or North Korea?
Well, let's throw another hot potato into that oven, because let's not forget about Afghanistan.
We haven't heard that for a while.
Exactly, the longest war in the history of the United States, still ongoing. What exactly is the end game there, and exactly what would victory look like, and so exactly how will the U.S. withdraw from Afghanistan, if ever? Still not quite certain, but at any rate, the U.S. is still there. And the latest headlines are that scores have been killed in attacks across central Afghanistan, 55 people killed in a string of bombings, including a double suicide bombing Monday morning in Kabul. So the violence there continues, and still just nothing, no sign that anything is going to change with the status quo, despite the fact that the U.S. has just named its 18th Afghan war commander.
Wow.
Can you imagine? The 18th Afghan war commander has just been named, and again, there's no sign whatsoever that the country has stabilized, quite the contrary. So, unfortunately, it's not just, you know, one area here or one area there. It's so many different things that are exploding all over the place that it's difficult to even keep track of them all.
You know, it's interesting. We had James Mattis. He was a speaker at the Air Force graduating class, the Air Force Academy. And he says, your primary weapon system now is your attitude. And he pretty much said, those here, you will be engaged in war in the near future. And so, you know, maybe that is something that's always said at the Naval, you know, at the Air Force Academy, you know, at graduation. Yeah. I don't know. But I guess
it's strange when you
everything.
Actually want that to be the case. You actually want it to just be rhetoric, you know.
Rhetoric, yes. Absolutely.
But unfortunately, there may be some truth to it.
Yes, I think so, too. And, you know, there was an interesting thing. We were talking earlier about the economy. We're about ready to run out of time, but the U.S. is launching an investigation into automobile imports on a national security basis. We have worsening friction over this international trade between the United States and its allies. And so President Trump has asked Commerce Secretary to carry out the Wilbur Ross to carry out the probe to see if the effects of imports of any article in the national security in the United States automobiles. So
yeah, which seems kind of strange thing to say on its face, but actually, as of course we get into the world of self-driving cars that are essentially computers that are, you know, driving themselves around the roads, there, I suppose there really is, I mean, fundamental security questions when you start to get to that level of technology. So, although I think this is probably more just about slapping tariffs and sanctions, and but in reality, I think there can really be a national security concern, at least in the next generation of cars that undoubtedly are going to be populating the roads very soon.
Yes, a very good point. Along with the ZTE and the telephones, you know, they present a security issue, and so what a strange world that we live in. Do you have any final thoughts, James? Anything that we didn't cover? Or?
Probably, but I'm probably just going to collapse into a corner and recover for the next day or two. I did appreciate the conversation, though. Thank you for having me on, as always.
Well, thank you, James, and it's always good to have you here, and we'll see you again in 2 weeks. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And remember our special, folks, we have the Mint 862 $10 Liberty Gold Piece, along with a $25 space value 90% dimes, BU dimes, for $1,030, and includes your shipping costs. Until then, ladies and gentlemen, be safe, good night, and God bless. Thank you, James.
I work all night, I work all day, to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. In my dreams,